From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory in for Marty Moskowain. Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has been found guilty on all counts for the murder of George Floyd. The trial featured compelling, emotional testimony from eyewitnesses who watched Chauvin hold his knee to Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds last May. It also featured expert testimony from medical officials who affirmed the cause of death was asphyxiation, as well as testimony from police officials inside and outside the Minneapolis department who stated unequivocally that Chauvin was outside the bounds of police training and protocol. So what does this mean for the movement for social justice, and especially for members of the Black community who have felt betrayed by the justice system in many cases over the years involving police and unarmed Black people? Talking to CNN, Vice President Kamala Harris said this of a guilty verdict in the case.
It will not take away the pain of the Floyd family. It will not take away the pain of the communities, all communities, regardless of their color or geographic location, that felt sadness and anger in what they witnessed in that video. This verdict is but a piece of it, and it will not heal the pain that existed for generations, that has existed for generations among people who have experienced and firsthand witnessed what now a broader public is seeing because of smartphones and the ubiquity of our ability to videotape in real time what is happening in front of our faces. Mm-hmm.
Joining us now to process the verdict are three guests we'll have during the hour. Elder Melanie DeBose is a pastor in Kensington and co-chair of the faith-based advocacy group Powers Live Free Project. Welcome, Elder Melanie DeBose.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We'll also have Devron Washington, a Black Lives Matter organizer in Philadelphia. Welcome, Devron.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Imani Perry, a professor of African American Studies at Princeton. So good to have you here, Professor Perry.
Thanks for having me.
Elder Melanie DeBose, I want to start with you. What was going through your mind when you heard the verdict?
Actually, hearing the verdict left me numb. Because it's difficult to celebrate someone's calamity, but at the same time, it breathed a breath of fresh air for my culture and our Black Lives experience, which for too long, the quality of our lives and the value of our lives has been overlooked. So what went through my mind was it's about time, and yet the verdict does not resolve all of the issues that we have experienced in this nation as an oppressed people.
I'm curious what you were expecting. Were you bracing for a different outcome?
I really had a lot of angst around it. Because as a 60-plus-year-old woman, I have seen too often our men and women in blue get away with this level of miscreant behavior, this level of murder, this level of disregard for human lives, Black lives, and walk away scot-free. And even now, I'm waiting with bated breath because I would like to not see the sentence fall featherlight. We need him to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Devron Washington, want to bring you into the conversation. As someone who organized many protests since George Floyd's murder, you spent a lot of time on the streets. You spent a lot of time organizing. What did this verdict mean for you, and was it sort of a validation of that effort?
I think, well, one, as an abolitionist, I felt relief like Elder Melanie, but I understand that there's so much work that needs to be done, and this could be looked at as kind of a blood sacrifice from the police department, especially with so many of the police officers having broken the blue wall of silence to testify against one of their own. While that's a good thing, the systemic issues that produced this heinous act are still intact. White supremacy is still intact. And so I'm thinking about how do you get at those issues?
We'd like to think that the justice system would serve justice, no matter the context, right? You would look at the facts of the case. But I'm wondering if you think that the protest movement, essentially helped make sure that, that justice was served in this case.
I think it was high profile. The whole world was watching. I definitely think that there was an impact. I also know that, you know, it wasn't just protests. And a lot of the work that's happening isn't just protests to make these changes happen. And while protest is also important. But yeah, there's a lot more work to be done.
Imani Perry, I want to get your personal take on the verdict, but also how you see this moment in the larger fabric of American history.
I guess my personal reaction was similar in that I was glad for the Floyd family because I know that this verdict was something that was important for them. It was colored for me dramatically by what we've experienced over the last week and a half. Just in terms of context, you know, so to think about the whole world is watching this trial and police are still killing people as this trial is happening. Even as, you know, there are people in Minneapolis who from the department who decided to distance themselves from him. And so, you know, I'm very, very cautious about thinking that this is signaling any sort of turning point. And really wondering, you know, what kind of intervention can we have that will cease the killing machine, essentially, you know, and I think organizers are doing critical work in thinking about how do we prevent this as opposed to how do we get individual officer accountability. We have an entire system that is profoundly dysfunctional, that is the engine for mass incarceration, this engine for surveillance and abuse of all sorts. And so I guess my reaction was, okay, yes. And then almost immediately, the same hour, you know, Makia Bryant, another child killed by a police officer in Columbus, a child who was seeking help. And that is, if nothing else, a symbol of how we should not be too sanguine or hopeful in this moment. There is so much work to do.
You bring up that case. You know, it seems like a lot of the facts are still being sorted through in that one. The police version, you know, is pointing to the idea that she had a knife and potentially she was about to harm someone else. But clearly there are so many times where it's more clear that the use of force is not justified and it becomes harder to figure out when it is justified. I'm curious how you think about that distinction, Elder Melanie DeBose.
So there is an absolute overabundance of the use of force. And one of the things that I don't know if I could call it happy, but one of the things that I realized and that I've been stating is that it took a pandemic of COVID-19 to expose an epidemic of racism in the United States, and particularly in our predominantly black and brown cities. The reality is a black or brown citizen does not have to do much of anything to be met with a gun and a bullet with someone standing behind or hiding behind a badge. So there's rarely provocation. A traffic stop could land someone black or brown dead.
Yeah.
And we watch our white siblings get off relatively scot-free. Mass murderers end up with a trip to Burger King before they go to be questioned or they get to the police department.
You're referencing Dylan Roof there.
I am, and they're handled so much more gently. But for our black and brown citizens, predominantly black, our officers seem to come with their finger on the trigger. And we already know that guns are hair trigger, and so are very sensitive. But they come with the idea that they're going to have to take a body. And we are resentful, we're in pain, and it has to stop.
I want to talk a little bit about the role of technology in bringing this tragedy to light, specifically the cell phone camera footage that went viral and ultimately was used by the prosecution in the conviction of Chauvin. As a point of contrast, let me read the headline on the Minneapolis police release the day after Floyd's murder. It simply said, "Man dies after medical incident during police interaction." But the world saw a much different story because of Darnella Frazier. It was the 17-year-old Frazier who was taking her 9-year-old cousin to the store when she stopped and filmed Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck. Let's hear a little bit of her testimony during the trial.
Was there anything about the scene that you didn't want your cousin to see?
Yes.
And what was that?
A man terrified, scared, begging for his life.
So tell the jury what you observed, what you heard when you stopped to look at what was happening there at the scene.
I heard George Floyd saying, "I can't breathe, please get off of me. I can't breathe." He cried for his mom. He was in pain. It seemed like he knew. It seemed like he knew it was over for him. He was terrified.
Devron Washington, I'm hoping you can react to that clip. And just thinking about the idea that this, if this happened only a few years ago, it's possible there might not have even been a trial without that video footage.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as previously said, it kind of speaks to the high bar that of evidence that folks need to have in order for police officers to be punished for their actions. And so it for me, what I'm sitting with is the fact that we have to literally be traumatized over and over again in a myriad of different ways. That's from the younger cousin who has to watch it happen to everyone who stood by for 9 minutes and were forced to be helpless while they watched someone die, in order for a police officer to be held accountable, not accountable, but to be punished for his actions. And I think that it's a really good example and very clearly lays out like what the plight is and the situation that we're in, because I think in other countries, they would not allow their police officers to kill someone in front of them. The public's response would be quite different, but here we've been socialized to think that we are powerless in that moment.
We are coming up on a break. You've been listening to Devron Washington, a Black Lives Matter organizer in Philadelphia, Elder Melanie DeBose, a pastor in Kensington, and Imani Perry, a professor of African American Studies at Princeton. And we want to hear from you. Email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. Leave us a note on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Times, or call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking this hour about the Derek Chauvin verdict. He was found guilty on all counts in George Floyd's killing, including second-degree murder. The verdict was unanimous and came from a diverse 12-person jury. We have three guests with us this full hour. Elder Melanie DeBose is a pastor in Kensington and co-director of the faith-based advocacy group Powers Live Free Project. We also have Devron Washington, a Black Lives Matter organizer in Philadelphia, and Imani Perry, a professor of African American Studies at Princeton. I want to pick up on something that Devron was talking about before the break, and that was the idea of re-traumatizing. And let's talk about how this trial, though necessary, was re-traumatizing for so many people who watched or listened to the proceedings. The images were disturbing. The witness testimony was gut-wrenching. We heard a little bit of that in the last segment. And the mental health implications here are real. And we know that there was a struggle, especially in the Black community, among those who felt conflicted about following along. Imani Perry, I'm hoping you can weigh in on this.
Yeah, I mean, I would want to place it in a larger context that we have corporations, media corporations, that repeatedly play the videos, footage of police officers killing black people, brown people. So there is the particularly kind of re-traumatizing experience of watching the trial, but it's also a part of a larger matrix of a kind of disregard for these horrific incidents that makes me very uncomfortable in terms of how people make money off of that phenomenon. I think in the context of the trial, at least, the voices we heard, you know, I think the prosecution put on an excellent case, incidentally, but the voices that we heard gave meaningful context by and large. Of course, there were some disturbing testimony as well, but I do think this question of the repetition and also the context is important. It is important to cherish people's lives, and it is important to be mindful of the impact of the loop of death, and not simply think that it's you know, a way of having a hot news take, but you know, a devastating event, a devastating repetition.
Elder Melanie DeBose, I'm curious how this has affected you as a faith leader. I'm sure that it feels sometimes you're carrying the weight of your community.
Yeah, sometimes I think about the fact that we were able to witness this at the intersection of the pandemic when we were all at home, and at the intersection of upbeat technology. So it has basically left the community members, and I pastor a Black and Latinx community, it left them in a quandary because, one, this is all too familiar. But secondly, we were glad to see our non-Black and Latinx siblings come to the streets and express their disdain for what they witnessed because they happened to be home, and the pandemic gave them nothing else to do but watch television. So it's painful. And as my brother here alluded, or one of them alluded to, the fact that in the wake of these tragic incidents, there are people whose lives are forever changed. The young lady who did the video, she articulated that well, but no one is speaking for the younger children and the older citizens, and all of whom were able to testify during the trial, all of whom were traumatized and visually shaken. So this impacts the emotional well-being, the mental health, the physical well-being, and I panic. My community panics because we are the mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, aunties of Black boys, men, uncles, fathers, and we see them all the time being thrown up against the wall, and we see them all the time being violently arrested. No conversation, just abusively arrested. And we have almost desensitized our children. I don't want to take long, but I run a summer camp at my church. And a couple of summers ago, before the pandemic, my children were playing a game, and they were literally grabbing one another, pinning their hands behind their backs and slamming them against the wall. Mm. So much so they were hurting one another's faces. And I said, what are you doing? We're playing cops. Mm. And I thought, how do I and my team, how do we re-channel or you know, do something to change the thinking of our kids who now see this as normal?
Yeah.
And wow. They have incorporated it into their play. This has had generational implications, and it didn't start with Mr. Floyd.
Right.
It started hundreds of years ago.
Well, thank you for sharing that anecdote. Devron Washington, I want to bring you in. You first kind of touched on this topic If you can speak to your personal experience, just with the re-traumatization that you were talking about.
Yeah, I think it's hard because it's something that we've been dealing with for a very long time now. I think I personally feel sometimes that I have a duty to like watch to see what happens, almost as bear witness, and it's always hard to see those images and just to see how little Black life is valued. But also too, there's this thing about white supremacy and power and the embodiment of that is shown through watching Derek Chauvin kneel on this person's neck with little regard, and also with the expectation that he's going to get away with it, right? Like he looked very secure in doing so. And I think, you know, alongside the death, that's something that also sticks with me, is just how bold white supremacy is right now. I mean, we are seeing that white supremacists have tried to take over, the state capital, I mean, the country's capital. And so I also am sitting with a great deal of worry for the future, understanding that, you know, we literally could be looking at a resurgence of fascism in this country. And it's demonstrated by all of these covert signs that we may not see the totality of until the future.
I want to bring in a little bit of the context as far as the data goes. You know, it's the court system clearly has given cops the benefit of the doubt in trials and proceedings related to excessive force. According to one study, 1,000 people or more die every year at the hands of police, and only 7 officers have been found guilty of murder since 2005. And it was pretty remarkable in this case to see police officers and police leadership testify against Derek Chauvin during the trial, really saying unequivocally that his actions were out of line and not rooted in department practice or training. I want to hear another clip from the trial. This is Minneapolis Police Chief Medaria Arredondo.
Once Mr. Floyd had stopped resisting, and certainly once he was in distress and trying to verbalize that, that should have stopped. And clearly, when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
So it was this sort of testimony that had many people feeling like this trial was just different compared to others in the past. Curious, Elder Melanie DeBose, what you make of what we just heard there?
Well, for starters, I'm grateful that the judge decided to allow the trial to be televised because it extended the exposure to the realities of what we as Black citizens have been experiencing. Once again, this part of the testimony really, really resonated because we call that in our hood overkill. And we witnessed what the officer did as overkill. And even when enough was enough, it was not enough. And his stoic disposition spoke to not only the racism, but the hatred. And I'm told that he was even as stoic at the end of the trial. And I began to wonder, was there anything in there? Was there a soul in there? Was there anything that just even remotely resembled humanity? So he never found enough to be enough. And even after he was convicted, he didn't seem to be moved by the reality. And so I hope his reality is really broad and very punitive.
Imani Perry, I want to bring you back into the conversation. You know, the prosecution in this case really focused their efforts on Chauvin. You know, they did not make this about the Minneapolis Police Department writ large or policing writ large. Some say that was kind of a recipe for success in getting the verdict that they got. But was that the right decision, Imani?
Well, you know, you have to try individuals on, you know, in a case like this. So you can't, I mean, they couldn't.
Yeah.
So just structurally, this is what had to happen. But I do think one of the pieces that was important about this that does go to policing writ large is that the police report, right, that came out when George Floyd was killed was filled with lies. And the same, we saw the same thing with Adam Toledo last week, who was a 13-year-old who was killed by police officers in Chicago with his hands up. And the initial report was that he was aiming a gun at police officers. And so I think one of the things, and this is why I did want to go back for a moment to Makia Bryant, because we cannot give the benefit of the doubt to a system in which there are repeated examples of police officers not telling the truth about incidents. They do not deserve the benefit of the doubt. There has to be other kinds of verification, because it's completely evident that it's quite frequent that there will be a distortion of the truth to evade the possibility of punishment. And so here's an instance in which there was a very long process. There were millions of people protesting, right? And that is what's required to get an honest rendering of what occurred, right, before you even get to the trial. So even in the individual instance, and even in the efforts to suggest that Chauvin is a complete outlier, which I simply don't think the evidence of the past 100 years suggests that. But even with that, there's something that is exposed about what kind of relationship we as citizens and community members writ large should have. A kind of skepticism, frankly, with the word of police officers in instances in which people wind up dead, especially children.
Yeah, yeah. I want to take a comment here from James. He writes in, "I'm hopeful for the first time. I do feel like we are at a tipping point." Elder Melanie DeBose, do you share enthusiasm? Do you think that there is a difference? Do you think that this is a sea change moment?
I hope. This is a very, very small, it seems large, but it's a very, very small step, because I'm thinking about the many parents who are still waiting for some sign of accountability or justice for their children, whose cases have been dismissed, whose the misbehaving officer, the murdering officer, has been reassigned to duty with a raise and sometimes with a promotion. So we are hopeful people, and we have the propensity to grab whatever glimmer of hope there is, but we're going to need more evidence, because we have been betrayed for so long and in so many ways. And that's why someone very creatively came up with the phrase Black Lives Matter, because they have not mattered. And so cautiously optimistic would probably way better than hopeful.
Yeah. One reaction that caught my attention right after the verdict was announced yesterday was from Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison. He said, and I quote, "I would not call today's verdict justice, however, because justice implies true restoration, but it is accountability, which is the first step towards justice." Devron Washington, I'm hoping you can help us expand this discussion on this point. What do you see as the distinction between justice and accountability?
Right. I think, well, one, I would like to kind of come at the premise and say that it's neither justice nor accountability. Mm. I think prisons, the way in which this country used them, perpetuate more harm than good to our communities. And so when you talk about real accountability, where someone atones for something that they've done, and then takes corrective measures to make amends, right? That cannot happen within the current criminal legal system that we have. So we will neither get justice nor accountability in this situation. And I think justice in this moment is looking at the system of policing in this country. And then for me, as an abolitionist, I say we need to dismantle it. I think for folks who are invested in policing, but see that reforms need to be made, I think there's a commonality there that we understand that we also need to reduce the funding that the police receive, right? And my vision for justice, and a lot of abolitionist organizers' vision for justice, is actually a more robust system of first responders and community supports that really provide a 21st century answer to the complex human and social issues that we see in our communities today. So that's everything from mental health services to proper supports for people experiencing domestic violence and poverty, and even folks who are struggling with substance use, those professions, those expertise is something that current police departments do not have, and gets muddled by the profit model of being basic tax collectors who stop people for petty crimes and write tickets to drum up revenue for their local municipalities.
Okay, well, we are coming up on a break, but Imani Perry, if you add a few thoughts quickly, we could fit them in here.
I would just add, I think that's a really wonderful point, and that we ought to keep in mind that the policing is directly connected to mass incarceration, and so that we can't separate out policing, and we do have to have a kind of systemic analysis of how to reduce the harm that happens in our community.
All right, we'll pick it up after the break. We're coming up on this break, like I said. You've been listening to Elder Melanie DeBose, a pastor in Kensington, Devron Washington, a Black Lives Matter organizer in Philadelphia, and Imani Perry, a professor of African American Studies at Princeton. And we want to hear from you. Email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. Leave us a note on Facebook and Twitter at WHYY Radio Times, or call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Marty Moscowane. We have three guests helping us unpack this historical occasion of the sentencing and guilty verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial. Elder Melanie DeBose is a pastor in Kensington and co-director of the faith-based advocacy group Powers Live Free Project. We also have been talking to Devron Washington, a Black Lives Matter organizer in Philadelphia, and Imani Perry, a professor of African American Studies at Princeton. I also now want to join WHYY's Layla Jones into the conversation. Layla is part of our Billy Penn Project. Layla, are you there?
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Thanks for joining us this morning, Layla. I really enjoyed the piece that you published last night about how, Black parents in the Philadelphia region are talking to their kids about this verdict and how to navigate that. So I wanted to invite you into the conversation to discuss some of the things you learned.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. I got the idea for that story because someone I'm familiar with launched an entire therapy practice dedicated just to speaking to children about race, their racial traumas, and how it affects them in the day-to-day. And so I thought about how parents would be speaking to their children about this trial, and that is Black parents mostly, but also parents of Black and brown kids who may not be Black themselves. And I just wanted to, get some tangible tips, because another acquaintance of mine on Twitter, he has a young daughter. He said, his daughter's a little too young to bring this topic up to her right now, but he didn't envy the parents who had to talk to their kids about this. And so I just wanted to try to give some tips to folks.
And any tips you want to highlight?
Yes, actually. And so one thing that I talked to two therapists, one is a psychotherapist named Dr. Sarita Lyons, another was a therapist named Erica Talbert, and they both said that the feelings of racial anxiety in your children might come up in ways that you may not recognize. So they're not necessarily going to be coming to you saying they feel tired of being black or they feel discriminated against. They might become depressed. They might not want to start doing things that they used to like doing. They might, you know, be afraid to go outside at certain times of the night, or if they're driving age, they might not want to drive around anymore for fear of being pulled over. So first they talked about identifying how your child might manifest racial trauma or just difficulty with this moment. The next thing that they said to do was for parents to evaluate themselves. And this was important, and Erica Talbert made this distinction that that's for black parents and also non-black parents, white parents, or any parents of any race, that if you have your own racial biases, you need to examine that before you go to your children to talk to them about these types of issues. And if you have your own racial traumas that are unresolved or unhealed, you might want to examine that before you go to your child, because like someone I spoke to, a parent, Cindy Bass, the council member, said, she doesn't want to impart and pass down her own anxieties from her generation onto her 11-year-old daughter, who might not be having that struggle with race that, you know, she had at that age. And so another thing that they mentioned was, if you can't write it, and I thought this was good, maybe try journaling. So if writing is, if you can't speak it, try writing it and journaling. If speaking and coming to your child might be awkward, it might be difficult, make it a family project. Buy journals, have a prompt, just sit down and have your kids, you know, write out or draw out, if they're too young, how they're feeling and just kind of what's going on.
Thanks for those insights, Layla. I want to bring our guests back into the conversation. Elder Melanie DeBose, Devron Washington, Imani Perry. I'm actually not sure if any of you are parents or how old your kids are, but if one of you wanted to jump in on if any of what Layla said resonated with you, that would be great.
So my last book was actually titled Read a Letter to My Sons, and many of these issues were central to it because my two sons are growing up in the context of the repetition of racial violence, particularly directed at their demographic, though not exclusively. And I will say, even though I spent an entire book writing to them about how not to internalize the ideology of white supremacy, how to imagine themselves big and important and deep human beings and not through the frames of the society, I really do think that we would do well to start to focus on the conversations that need to be had with white children to ensure that they don't grow up repeating these attitudes, that this should not be a conversation that is only a burden children of color. It is something that white people who see themselves as either anti-racist or non-racist or don't want to be racist have a responsibility to ensure that their children don't grow up and become people who sustain racial inequality and white supremacy.
Devron Washington or Elder Melanie DeBose, you want to jump in on that?
Sure. For me, these conversations started way before the Floyd murder. I am a parent and a grandparent, and about 6 years ago, I had two grandsons born, one of each, born to both of my daughters, and I had a lot of anxiety around that, and I had to really engage my faith to keep myself calm and to remember, just teach them how to comport themselves and hope that when they've done everything correctly, they will still emerge from it alive and well. So not only do I instill these lessons in my children and grandchildren, but I have nephews, grandnephews, great-grandnephews. I have children. Our corporate name is Children's Mission, and we bring in all of the children in the community for various educational programs. And so we try to instill not only the importance of academics, but the importance of how to conduct yourself in a hostile environment, which this world is toward us.
We do have a caller, Clay. You have a question for our guests?
A question or comment. I I guess I'm a pessimist at heart. I see this as a one-off. Everybody's happy that we got there. He was found guilty, and that's wonderful. But I think we need to hold off and not go too far afield and find out what the sentence is going to be. And the reason I think this is a one-off is because this crime was so egregious, the thin blue line that protects cops couldn't help him this time. He had almost 10 minutes of murder. So, the thin blue line couldn't help him this time. But what about all the other murders where there's no citizen soldier there to take the pictures? We have to rely on the cops telling the truth when they make their report. Well, we know that doesn't happen. And if you ask the Reverend there, she would tell you what I would tell you if you believe that way, that no sin is going to go into non-existence until we're all in hell or all in heaven, whatever our lives have earned us. So bigotry and racism, it does exist and will exist forever until, if you believe in heaven or hell, we're all there. We're all in one place or the other.
So well, thank you for that. Thank you for that call, Clay. Point well taken. And I'm curious to bring Devron Washington back into it. To this point, is it going to take legislative change for the sorts of reforms that you're imagining, it seems?
I think that's part of it. But I think what's actually more important is for our communities and folks who are concerned about this not to lose focus of the system that is producing these outcomes, right? Like a big part of the scientific process is having results that you can duplicate, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what he's talking about here quite clearly is that these results are not guaranteed going forward, you know? And so really the conversation should be, what does this moment tell us about this system, right? What does it mean that the thin blue line is broken? What are the opportunities that arise from this moment in time that brings us closer to the liberatory vision that I think we all hold for, in particular, the Black community?
So what do you think about those, I guess, national and local reforms that are being talked about? There was many politicians yesterday who were talking about the George Floyd Justice Policing Bill that was passed by the House. It bans chokeholds, makes it easier to pursue claims of police misconduct, bans no-knock warrants in certain cases, prohibits racial and religious profiling, redirects funding to community-based policing reforms. So there's that national conversation that's happening, but of course, much of policing is a local matter, and we've been kind of dealing with a debate in Philadelphia and other municipalities around here on police reforms as well. I guess, Elder Melanie DeBose, have you been following along with that debate, and do you see hope for reforms on the local level that you would envision?
Well, absolutely. We have to remain optimistic, as pessimistic as everything really may be or really appear to be. Philadelphia's or power, Live Free, has been fighting for just such reforms. And we recognize that not only do we have to protest, but we also have to be at the table with legislators where decisions are made. So we do both. And what we're looking at now is a change in the process whereby police miscreant behaviors or egregious acts are investigated. We have found, and it's been proven for years, that police can't police themselves. And so we have asked for the abolishment of the PAC, which is the Police Advisory Commission, which existed for several years in Philadelphia, but clearly has had no teeth. It's been grossly underfunded, and they have a vision for what they need to accomplish, but it has been unsuccessful. And we have been uplifting, and the citizens, over 70% during the November 3rd election, voted for an independent, citizens-based, independent commission that will oversee. And we're calling for accountability in the police department, and this will be overseen by a citizens-based commission. Accountability, transparency, and for that commission to be adequately funded to the tune of no less than $20 million a year so that they can also do investigations to make sure that when citizens' complaints are railed, they will be properly investigated and the proper level of justice or accountability will be handed out to police who cross that line and who have also taken the lives of black folks so lightly.
All right, to clarify, you know, Devron's talking about abolition. It seems like your vision of the police department would be more summed up as a reimagining of their duties and how they spend their time.
Yeah, we have really looked into the concept of abolishment, and we just lean to the reality that all police are not terrible. Some and perhaps many are. But to totally abolish will leave the areas in which they are useful. And so we have been really reimagining a concept of a police department wherein the blue, the badge, and the gun does not answer every issue. And we're looking at the reallocation of funding because they're funded to the tune of above $700 million a year, and yet they have proven not to be very productive. I think last time I looked, over 41% of the homicides were unsolved,
right.
And the trust factor between police and the citizens, particularly of Philadelphia, is so low that the level of participation that they would need to even get the kind of information from the citizens, it's not there because we as a community do not trust the police. And lastly, they have such a blanket of protection. They call it qualified immunity. So not only are we fighting on the city level, the local level, but we're also having to wage warfare at the state level because they have a blanket of protection that allows them to conduct themselves in egregious ways and walk away scot-free.
Imani Perry, I want to bring you in on this conversation to get your thoughts on, it seems like, kind of somewhat competing visions that Elder Melanie DeBose and Devron Washington have laid out.
In some ways, but there's a lot of common ground. I mean, I think that one of the things that, and Devron said this, that it was really is really important, that so much can be done before you even get to the question of abolition. I think of it as there's a dispositional question, right? So do we think that the way to solve social problems is locking people in cages? Do we think that the way to solve social problems is arresting people as opposed to giving them care? I think when the answer is no, then the current system seems completely untenable and unjust, right? So you have communities that don't have access to mental health services, inadequate care, inadequate housing, inadequate schools, right? And then the response to the challenges of those communities being people walking around with guns threatening them, you know, that is not, I think, there's not a legitimate argument for that, right? So as far as I'm concerned, if we approach this with massive decarceration, most people who are in prison and in jails are not in prison jails for violent crime, massive decriminalization because there are these petty offenses that should not be subject to criminal law intervention, right? And frankly, reduction in funding is important because you give police officers a reason to interface with communities, to have more artillery and to use it because they're funded at such extraordinary levels. And I think that, you know, is consistent in many ways with an abolitionist sensibility, because the idea is we think about orienting ourselves to the society in a way that is not punitive. I don't think we even have to, though, claim the mantle of being abolitionist in order to see that.
All right. Well, we have to wrap it up there. We could do a whole nother hour on this topic. Thank you so much for your time, Imani Perry, Professor of African American Studies at Princeton. Thank you so much, Devron Washington, Black Lives Matter organizer and leader, and Elder Melanie DeBose, a pastor in Kensington and co-chair of the faith-based advocacy group Powers Live Free Project. We also heard from WHYY's Layla Jones for the Billy Penn Project. Engineered today was Charlie Kyer. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Kevin McCrory in for Marty Moskowitz. Thanks for joining us.